In the fall of last year, 2012, ECW Press released the book Too Much Trouble, a very oral history of Danko Jones, written by Stuart Berman. Over 70 participants, everyone from Lemmy to Jella Biafra, Mike Watt, John Garcia, Eddie Spaghetti, Damian Abraham, Blaine Cartwright, Bruce LaBruce, Donald Tardy, David Vincent, Don Jameson and Jim Florentine, Peaches, Brent Hines, Michael Ackerfeld, Dallas Green, and dozens more are documented telling the story of our band within its pages. Episode number 30 of this podcast commemorates the night of the book's release, where author Stuart Berman, JC, and myself held a discussion with CBC Music's Vish Khanna moderating. As much as this was a memorable night, I thought it would be best to bring Stuart back onto the podcast for a one-on-one sit-down discussion on how this book came to be, anecdotes Stuart acquired during the making of, and our past history together. Of course, this talk of ours inevitably branched out into other tangents, and many digressions were made. Whether you've read the book yet or are thinking about picking it up, which I highly suggest you do, this episode pries into our band, shedding some behind-the-scenes POVs, which I hope you enjoy. I should note the outro music for this episode is Stuart's band, The Two Koreas, just in case you're left wondering at the end. Also, this podcast wouldn't happen if it wasn't for our great sponsors, Blue Mic Microphones and their Yeti mics, and Skull Candy headphones. I don't go anywhere without the Aviators or the Mixmaster mic headphones. And it should be noted, I should have noted that during last podcast with Chris Jericho and Damian Abraham, we used the Yeti Blue mics. We made a mention of them, but failed to say that it was truly indeed the Yeti Blue mics that I carted around with me all over Australia, procuring podcast after podcast during the Soundwave Festival. So every Australian podcast that you'll hear in the next few months were done with these Yeti Blue mics. And it also should be noted that every time I took the Yeti Blue mics out of the box, it impressed every guest. I actually gained immediate legitimacy in each guest's eyes once I took out the Yeti Blue mics. I can't really tell you who it was because I don't want to ruin the surprise of future podcasts. So just to let you know that all the Australian podcasts were done with the Yeti Blue mics. Okay, here we go. I'm talking about our book, Too Much Trouble, yet again. This time with the author, Stuart Berman, is this episode's guest on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. All right, so I have here Stuart Berman, the author of a book about us. Too Much Trouble is the name of the book. Stuart Berman is the author. And we did a podcast earlier with Vish Khanna from the CBC. But I thought it would be best to just do a one-on-one, you and I, and talk about this book and give people a real insight as to how it came about, your relationship, our relationship, and just various particulars about making this book happen for anyone who might not even be into the band, just the whole routine of not routine, but whole process of going through making a book like this, which is an oral history on our band. Welcome to the podcast, Stuart Berman.
Thank you. I feel very honored to finally get a real podcast as opposed to the, you know, live club podcast, which was nice and all, but you know, this feels a little more special.
I've known you for years.
Yes.
Whether people know it or not. And it's, you came up to me, I think at Lee's Palace or something, and you knew of the radio show I did, or how was that?
Yeah, I grew up in North York, which was, you know, within close proximity to the York University campus where you attended school.
Yeah.
And York had a radio station called CHRY, or still does, actually. And I would listen to radio at night going to bed. Instead of watching TV, I would sit by my radio with a remote control and sort of flip through the channels. And I stumbled across your show, The Seminal Load, on Sunday nights. And it really introduced me to a lot of great bands, a lot of bands that even factor into the book, like The Makeup and Caius. So it...
Can we talk about another way we got to know each other, which is personal?
What, it wasn't just our love of music?
No. We liked the same girl.
At different points in history.
At different points. But when we met, I think it wasn't at first, but I eventually put two and two together and I said, oh, this guy likes her too. And it's all hazy now. But I it's not that I didn't like you because I didn't know who you were. Like, I didn't know you. But I just, when I would think of you, I'd think of her and I'd just, what's going on here?
Right.
So that was an interesting thing. And then I think as the years went on and we got to know each other better and we became friends, the girl that we both liked, you know, was an afterthought, really. We became friends.
Yeah.
And
I think we bonded over the fact that we both got nowhere with her.
We both got nowhere. And yes. I think that was what made us even, you know, closer friends. We were just like, hey. Yeah. I think it was like a moment where we both threw up our hands and said, hey.
Well, I was like, well, if Danko Jones can't get anywhere with this girl, then, you know, I'm in good company.
And I was like, and I'm Danko Donovan.
And that was, you know, and that was right when you were coming out onto the scene. You were the hip, cool kid in town at that point. You couldn't even capitalize on that and parlay that into some fun.
If I'm zoned in on one person, and I was zoned in on this one girl for quite a while, maybe because nothing was happening. But you know, I got a yes. And then I got a no. And then I got a yes. And then I got a no. And you had something very similar happen, right?
Well, we actually became very close friends. So that sort of complicated, you know, matters as well. It was, you know, Dawson's Creek was on TV around that time. And there was very much a Dawson-Joey back and forth going on there.
So what would that make me in the Dawson's Creek cast?
Well, you're Pacey, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Bright. Charismatic. Second banana.
Right. And that's probably why we became friends. And this third party, this other girl, became the, well, was the thorn that started it all.
I can see a pattern, though, when you're talking about, you know, obsessing over that which you cannot have. You know, in this book, Canada is sort of the girl that you can't have. And even though you have, you know, been very successful in many other countries, there's something about that country close to home that you can't, that won't accept you. Is that you know, my psychology 101 reading?
It's a very, very accurate observation, and that is why you are the writer.
Yes. And I see the big picture.
I'm the lowly reader reading this as you send it to me.
Although, hey, you know, I put 2 years of my life into this book, and I just get a podcast in return.
When you wrote the Broken Social Scene book, This Book is Broken, you know, there's a few of the guys, especially Brendan Canning, very close with, I lived with, we're buddies. But I looked at their band, which was started after our band, and I thought, well, a lot of the people in the book are regional, like local Toronto scenesters. I think there was only a couple. Jay Mask is being a notable, you know, out-of-towner in the book. and
the Broken Social Scene.
In the Broken Social Scenes book, a name, if you will.
Yeah, we got Scott Camberg from Pavement, and some of the guys from Block Party are in there as well. Okay. So there's
I've just revealed to everyone that I've never been the biggest Pavement fan.
Right.
All my friends for years have tried to get me on the Slanted Enchanted bandwagon, and I never could understand. I tried. Trust me, man. I'd sit there with that album and listen to it, trying to decode what everybody could hear that I couldn't, and I never got on it.
See, it's funny, because when I think of Pavement, my first exposure to them was through CHRY, so might not have been through your show, but I sort of associated with
Trust me, there was, and when I say friends, a lot of those friends were at CHRY who were trying to get me on that train. No, that just didn't work.
It's funny you bring up Broken Social thing, because one of my first memories of talking to you is with Kevin Drew at the Cameron House. You and Brendan Canning had your DJ night there. I think it was, or maybe it was just one DJ night there.
Oh, really?
I think Wednesday nights, Melanie Kay used to book sort of quote unquote industry folk.
Oh,
to
she
DJ
did. Okay.
Musicians. I at that time also qualified as industry folk. So I was hanging out at the Cameron House a lot. And I remember having a conversation with you and Kevin Drew, who I just met on the spot that night.
Oh, okay.
And it was about pornography. So when you were talking earlier about that other thing we had in common, I thought you were talking about
pornography.
Our favorite
Have we stars. Outed Kevin as a
No,
porno?
Kevin's lyrics are all about porn and sex and semen. So it's there's no he even has a song called Love and Porn.
Oh, okay, because Kevin and I would, we would sit, I used to live with Brendan, and Kevin would come over all the time, and we'd have many discussions about Ginger Lynn, because we both grew up with Ginger Lynn, and we were both fans. So I've known Kevin to be kind of a big porn head.
Yeah. At his home, he's got all those, like, Richard Kern books, you know, art books.
Oh, those Taschen books?
Quote-unquote art books.
Right.
And, he knows the stuff.
You just take a porno mag, put hardbound it, you know, put a hardcover to it, and call it art.
Yeah,
passion. And speaking of Richard Kern, Dentata, which is a local Toronto band, they have a video called Earwig, which was directed by Richard Kern.
Yeah, it's funny to see Richard Kern's whole sort of renaissance now.
A renaissance going on?
Well,
I love
Vice magazine is all over him, and you know they shoot films with him.
I love Richard Kern's stuff, and I think he did a bang up job for that Dentata song and video and that band. And that's how I found out about the band, is because I saw the video and I realized they're from Toronto. I'm like, well, why haven't I heard about these guys? And they opened for us the last time we played Toronto.
Well, it's an interesting thing now. It's like, you know, back when you were starting out, the scene was very easy to comprehend in a way. You could identify it a lot more easily.
Yeah.
And I think this is true in any city. Like, I think the idea of a local music scene is sort of almost antiquated right now, because the internet just has exploded the, you know, opportunities for access. So, you know, I'll hear about a band from Toronto that I've never heard of, has no connection to any kind of identifiable scene, but through SoundCloud, they managed to, you know, get signed to a big label in the UK. So you don't see that kind of.
How does that make you feel as like a kind of a local music pundit, you know?
Well, it's changed my sort of focus a bit.
Have you felt you've lost control?
Yeah, I don't know if we ever had control per se, but it was just, I think, it used to be a lot easier to identify movements.
At least control in terms of like mapping out stuff and knowing.
Yeah, just getting the lay of the land. Now there's just so much music all the time that you don't even know where it's coming from exactly.
I'm overwhelmed.
Sometimes you don't find out until much later. It's like, oh, they're from Toronto. Crazy.
Right.
I've never heard of them before. I've never seen their name on shows, because a lot of music these days doesn't even require you to perform in front of a live audience due to technology. So it's an interesting time. It's on the other hand, it sort of constantly motivates you to keep discovering stuff, because you never know what you're going to find. I think it's becoming harder to become a true authority on things. We're sort of living in an age of generalists, and you know, you can sort of try to keep tabs on a lot of things, or you can just devote yourself to one specific
specialize
niche.
yeah which is what I find a lot of people are doing as well.
Yeah, and there's always value in niches. Like, there'll always be like an underground noise scene.
Yeah, And I feel like that's where we are as a rock band who've taken on or who are influenced by bands who, you know, past bands that were, you know, very, very, very popular arena bands almost. And they've influenced our sound. And yet, like you said, inundated by the amount of music, we could never reach that level, I don't think. But happy to be part of like a niche kind of place that, you know, will appeal to people who like this. You know?
Well, that's been the interesting thing about the last couple of years is rock, classic rock music is now just a niche among many as opposed to,
yeah,
you know, the dominant art form that it was when we were kids.
Which I find interesting. I find disheartening. But at the same time, you just got to roll with the punches. Just keep doing it. We're lucky as a band to have started before all this happened, before Bandcamp and SoundCloud and iTunes. So we have a history behind us, and we have a base of people who followed us through the years. And, you know, we're a name enough to keep it going where people can recognize it. But getting back to when you wrote the Broken Social Scene book, I remember reading it and you actually approached me, and I'm in the book. You approached me for some quotes, a few you didn't use because
I should say that I interviewed Danko at a coffee shop, or sorry, it's Pusateri's in Yorkville.
Yeah,
we don't screw around with mere coffee shops. We go to the finest
gourmet food store. In case,
you know, and I got a lot of material from that interview because, in case you haven't noticed, Danko likes to talk and he's got a lot of great stories. But then the next day, he sent me about, like, I don't know, like a 2,000-word email of additional material.
Oh, I did. I don't remember.
Which was a little more pointed and brazen than the conversation that we had. So,
well, you know,
some of it was used, some of it was not.
Broken Social Scene, if nobody knows, is more of a collective, and they kind of spawned this kind of new way of being a band. Really, I think maybe a couple other bands are like this. Godspeed, they're all from Canada. Arcade Fire are like this, but these loose collective. But Broken is more of a loose collective where members are in and out, and there's only a core of what, three or four guys who have been there since day one. Two guys have been there since day one. There's another guy who's been there since day two. And so over the years, we've crossed paths with various members, and I've had good experiences like Brendan Canning and bad experiences like a couple other people who are not Brendan Canning. And I think those were the emails I sent you about those people.
Which, you know, I had to keep things on point. And that's the thing with doing these oral histories is, you know, the challenge is creating a through line between all the different people's quotes.
Yes.
And making sure it flows like a movie script in a way.
I did not know the process at the time.
So there was a lot of tangents that have to be sort of shaved off in order to keep the show on the road.
But one thing that I was left with after I saw the book and I read it and stuff, I said, well, our history is longer. Our timeline's longer. We've, at the point when Broken Social, this book is Broken, came out, Broken had already, you know, done the, you know, achieved certain levels of success and popularity and appearances on Letterman, et cetera, et cetera. They made many inroads. But I still felt, even though we'd never been on Letterman or anything, our history is rich enough to document and read back.
Yeah.
And I approached you for it, and you were very surprisingly hesitant to take up the project.
Well, the thing with Broken Social Scene is there was a very obvious narrative arc that presents itself. Because even though the band formed in 2000, this history dates back several years before to when these relationships were formed. And a lot of the people in the band were also in other groups throughout the 1990s that were coming up in the sort of post-Nirvana age where any band with a flannel shirt was getting a record contract in Canada as well, especially. So these are people who had tried to play the game, as it were, and got rejected and found themselves at the end of the 90s with no record contract, no label, no career in some cases. And then they sort of mobilized and formed this sort of super group, and that, and did it completely on an independent level. And their timing was really uncanny, because it was also just at that moment where the internet was all of a sudden changing the way people first heard music, and, you know, bands without major label support could all of a sudden get a lot of exposure in the US, which was very hard to do in the 90s, as you can attest as well. So, you know, there was a real sort of underdog, sort of rising up against the man kind of story with Broken Social Scene. And with that, you could also tie in a lot of narratives about the way the industry was changing, and they were sort of emblematic of how the internet can really push your band forward. With you guys, you know, I just saw the story, you know, I saw you guys just from, you know, taking the broad view that you guys have been doing what you've been doing for 15 years, and you've, you know, amassed your sort of core fans, and, you know, it from the outside didn't look like the most dramatic narrative. So it wasn't until I actually, you know, went back and thought about everything you'd actually been through, and you've had all these weird little turns in your career, sort of this weird little zigzaggy road, you know, from the long view, it just looks like you've been on a straight line. But when you actually do a close up, you could see that, yeah, there was a lot of weird twists and turns along the way, and that sort of formed this really unique narrative. So, yeah, I had to, you know, take a little time and research your story more, because, you know, I knew I was pretty up on your history up until, say, 2002. And then you guys start spending a lot more time elsewhere. So,
yeah,
you know, and you would give me the updates, but I didn't actually see the full scope of, you know, what you'd accomplished until.
And I thought that your, you know, your original hesitation fell in line with the feeling that I was getting from the rise of Broken Social Scene from a lot of other people, whether it was people in the industry or just like the general populace, that this is what's cool now. Broken Social Scene is what's cool. You guys are not cool. To break it down into a high school level. And I felt, well, we know all those guys. Those guys, a lot of those guys are friends. And whether I lived with Brendan Canning or not, you know, we're friends. A lot of, yeah, I'm friends with Kevin Drew. I'd like to say now that I'm friends with Charles. And I think did make up. But then since then, of course, it's a yin yang thing. And I don't know how I left it off with another member of Broken Social Scene the last time I saw him. But anyways, the point I'm trying to make is, that's how we felt, which is what's reflected in the book, obviously, that we got this. I don't care if people don't like our band and don't support our band, but this, it was more than that. It was a full rejection of like who we are as who we were as people. Like we were just this lowbrow coffee time type band. And on stage during like the banter that I have a tendency to go off on, I've played it up and I've almost embraced it. There was a period of the band when I really felt this rejection from like the indie rock world, which is where we're really from, to be honest. I embraced the rejection. And I said, you think we're this lowbrow, knuckle-dragging, coffee time type band? Okay, we are.
Yeah.
And your original hesitation temporarily confirmed what I had been feeling. And so I just went back and I said, okay, fine. You know, that's okay. I think, well, we could really do this book, but I approached you first and only you because I felt much like you have with Broken Social Scene, you have these ties with everyone that are, you know, you know all the guys in the band and everyone's really cool with you. You have this rich history of just being in the scene, watching everything develop from its embryonic stage to Letterman. and you know, you could read it in the Broken Social Scene book. And you also have this kind of international, all your writings with Pitchfork and CMJ as well?
That was a long time
ago. Long time ago. But I mean, I'd watch, you know, the Pixies, Loud, Quiet, Loud. Is that what it's called? Loud, Quiet, Loud. And you're the voice on the phone that Frank Black's doing an interview with. It's not mentioned. Your name isn't there, but I know you. And I'm like, that's Stuart.
I still actually had to sign a release form for that. Because actually my name is on screen on the...
At the credits.
No. He's holding up like the itinerary during the phone interview.
And okay, I saw it a long time ago.
My name is on the list. So I had to sign a clearance form.
What if that shot wasn't used?
Maybe
you probably would have still had to sign something.
I was kind of worried, you know, when they approached me with the clearance form, and I was like, wait, is he going to be making fun of me on the other end of the line, like pointing at the receiver going, who is this idiot?
Yeah.
But I didn't know he was shirtless during that phone interview either. So that was very exciting to find it. But getting back to the book.
Getting back to you, though, that's the reason why I asked you, and strategically as well, because there are people in our lives, ex-members and other people, that don't like us very much for different reasons. And
which are all outlined in the book.
Yeah. But, you know, I think, well, there's two people you couldn't get who didn't want to be part of the book. But I thought you have such a great reputation as being like very fair, that a lot of the ex-members felt safe in your hands. You know, Gavin Brown, Damon Richardson, these are guys that, you know, we're not on the best relation with, but you're fine with them and they trust you. And so I figured that was another reason why I asked you.
Yeah, and the more I thought about it, I realized, you know, this book would be a lot of fun to take on a personal level. You know, I was able to kind of go back and document a moment of my life, you know, in the 90s when I was first sort of getting involved in music in Toronto, and bands like yours and the Deadly Snakes were a big part of sort of immersing me in Toronto music. And it's almost like a yin yang to the Broken Social Scene story. You know, I'm a Libra, so I've always liked to balance my noise with my pop. You know, I would say my, you know, two all-time favorite bands are, you know, the Beatles and the Stooges, and sort of my tastes sort of branch off from those starting points. So in a way, this was Broken Social Scene book sort of covered the sort of more elegant, refined side of indie rock, and this sort of delved into the dirtier, uglier side, and both of which have been, you know, very important in my life. And then on a sort of larger, you know, big picture scale, I think, as we were talking about earlier, this was a way to analyze the sort of diminishing power of rock and roll in this sort of post-internet age, and how, you know, the institutions that once supported new rock bands, specifically radio, have sort of ignored a lot of new rock music.
Yeah.
And become very safe, very formulaic, or just play anything made before 1980. So, you know, a band like yours might not make sense for you to be written about on, say, Stereo Gum or one of these sites. But, you know, if Q107 was doing its job properly and still nurturing new bands, you guys
would win
the homegrown
Q107
Jesse
homegrown
and Gene talent show competition.
I remember when Forgot It in People was quietly released on Arts and Crafts, and nobody knows this until now. I took 5 copies to Europe, and I remember my dad drove me to the airport, to Pearson International Airport, and I had the copies. I was going to put it in my carry-on, and I forgot it in the car. And I was so hell-bent on giving certain people in Europe a copy of this amazing album from my friend, my roommate. I called my dad. I was already in line to check in, and they were already driving. My dad was already driving home. And I said, could you please mail me the CDs? If you can't turn around, because we're going in soon, it's too late. Could you mail it to me? He mailed me, "You forgot it in people," the way my dad has a tendency. He's very anal. And he packaged it in a way that like a pit bull couldn't even bite his way through. And it was 5 copies of You Forgot It in People. And I gave a few to certain people. So a lot of people don't know that I tried to help Broken in my small way, way back in, I think that was originally released in 01.
02.
So 02 was like, and I remember I got the package in Copenhagen, Denmark. We were playing in Copenhagen that night. So I've always been supportive of the indie rock scene. And when I felt that sting of rejection from people, I was just like, fuck, man, you guys don't know. You don't know anything about this music. You don't know where it comes from. You don't know how it got there. You know, all those dudes in Broken, when we went on tour with Motorhead and Saxon, Brandon got mad at me because I didn't bring him a Saxon t-shirt because he loves Saxon. And we bonded over our mutual love of heavy metal music when we lived together.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a generational thing. I mean, just imagine kids who are getting into Black Sabbath in 1971 and you trying to tell them, you know, actually this music comes from, you know, Cream and The Who and, you know, Muddy Waters, and, you know, kids back then might have been like, ah, who gives a shit about that stuff? I just care about Black Sabbath. So
fair enough.
Fortunately, I think about this a lot, you know, for a kid getting into music now and trying to make sense of the history, must be such a daunting task. I mean, when we grew up,
yeah,
you know, there was sort of a defined canon that you had to, you know, that you could be directed to and study. You know, if you wanted to get into hardcore, you kind of knew which hardcore records were the cream of the crop, thanks to books and magazines and things like that. Or if you're getting into krautrock, you knew sort of which albums you had to have. And now, there's just so much music and so many micro genres and so many people creating music all over the world, which we now have access to, that it's kind of like, where do you start and how do you make sense of things and you know, how do you learn your history when you're constantly being, you know, inundated with the present? So, you know, with each generation, there's going to be a bit of a disconnect between what came before. And
I really just feel that there should be an open, with this overwhelming music scene we have now, there should be with it an open-mindedness that, yeah, I feel is not happening with the amount of music. Like, kids who are into metal are not into indie rock, like folk stuff, and vice versa. It's still, you still have these like hard dividing lines, and I just feel that it shouldn't really be that way. I mean, yeah, I'm on the short end of this stick, of course, because it's Arcade Fire on the cover of Time magazine and playing with Mick Jagger and not our band. But at the same time, if it was the other way around, I'd still be championing like small indie bands. I mean, I'm not so vocal about it now. I just quietly listen to indie rock. I'm not going to tweet about this great indie rock band that I had. I'd rather tweet about a great rock band, 'cause I find that they're unheard and ignored.
Well, I think once upon a time, indie rock was a political gesture, almost. Like you were saying, I'm going to try to do this my own way outside of the music industry, and I'm going to collaborate with like-minded people who are all sort of committed to the same DIY cause. Now there's no, that sort of romanticism and ideology are kind of gone. It's just like a bunch of bands making music and spitting it out there. So I don't, like, indie rock as a term is just becomes more and more vague with each passing year. So it's just who's good and who isn't good.
It was independent of major labels. And since their voice has been kind of cut down.
Yeah. That's like, what are you rebelling against? Really? Yeah. I mean, there's different things to rebel against, but it's just, it seems like major label artists and indie artists are all kind of trying to do the same thing, which is like get as many YouTube hits as possible.
Or, yeah,
you know, and they're all kind of competing on the same field. Don't get me wrong, obviously there's a big difference between Lady Gaga and your average indie rock band, but it feels like the way we discover music is all in the same place. It's all in this online viral kind of
sphere. Like bands like Walk Off the Earth.
Yeah, I think the book is hopefully starts, you know, a lot of discussions about, you know, the state of music and, you know, how can a band become successful in this world where, you know, the old rule book's sort of been scrapped. And, you know, I think it's interesting about the Danko Jones story is you've developed this fan base and you've found success in a way that almost defies, you know, sort of standard logic on both the mainstream level and an indie rock level. And I mentioned this in the book when, you know, we start getting into the section where all your peers and the bands you grew up loving sort of start professing their admiration for you, and that everybody got into this band a different way. It wasn't like one single or one particular album.
Yeah.
Everyone had this weird circumstantial route to get to you. And, you know, a lot of it was chance. A lot of it was timing and good luck. But, you know, that's all added up to a really big fan base. It was interesting interviewing some of the people who I assumed were huge fans of you and them saying to me, well, actually, I haven't really kept in touch with the band. I haven't heard them in 10 years. You know, I just think they're amazing people and I support what they do.
And there are a few other people like that I was surprised that of their answers that I thought would be a little more positive that weren't. And nothing from me, man. I just, whatever happened.
Well, I think that's an important part of the story is that you had a whole turnover in fan base, which a lot of bands don't get to experience. I mean, a lot of bands will come out of the gates, have their initial fans, and then they lose them. And then they have nowhere to go from there.
Yeah.
Whereas you, as you were losing sort of one set of fans, the sort of garage rock hipster types, you were gaining a whole new fan base overseas.
And that wasn't a conscious thing, but when I... what became conscious of it, I embraced it.
You know, it's hard. I think being a garage rock band is one of the hardest things to do because, A, there's so many of them, and you need to come out of the gates with something that's really, really smoking and really grabs people's attention. But evolving out of that is always a tricky proposition because it's either you kind of be the Ramones and sort of hammer out the same record forever, or you try to, you know, or basically turn into the Rolling Stones and sort of temper your sound and become more traditionalist. So it's
and lose your fan base.
And then you lose the
entirely
fans. Yeah.
Which were the only fans you got. I mean, if you're gonna make that jump, you better have someone there to catch you in terms of like maybe airplay or you know, a nice write up. If you can go from being like the Mummies to the Black Keys and get iTunes or Starbucks to sell your record, then you're set.
And that's why I think the White Stripes are a remarkable band, because I think they evolved but kept it weird and kept the mystique and, you know, were able to get played on FM radio, yet we're still, like, live. You see them, and it was just like seeing them in 1999. Like,
they're amazing. I also think garage rock music is a pose. It's more of a pose in 2012, especially with, you know, GarageBand, and you can make your band sound good. Now, if you're making your band sound deliberately bad, that's opposed to me.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a posture. Because there, a true garage rock band was born in a garage or in a basement, and they sound the way they sound because A, they didn't know how to play their musical instruments, and B, they didn't have enough money to go into a proper studio, but they wanted to.
Yeah.
All those bands were influenced by the Stones. They wanted to be the Stones. And to really follow the real trajectory of a garage rock band is to be a garage rock band, play songs, get fans, get money together, go into a studio, record a better sounding record, and take it bigger and bigger, just like the Stones did. That's how I see garage rock.
And I think new bands have the benefit of hindsight and seeing, like, where did the Stones go wrong or where did they lose their way, and avoiding that those sorts of pitfalls.
Right.
You know. Although I have a soft spot for Emotional Rescue.
I was gonna say
and Undercover of the Night.
I love Emotional Rescue and I love an Undercover of the Night. Is there one or two stories that stick out in trying to track down these characters for the book? Anything that you took when you keep from the whole project?
Well, actually, I thought one Friday afternoon I got to speak to Jello Biafra and Mike Watt back to back, like 5 o'clock and 5:30. And, you know, that's not something I ever thought would happen.
That's pretty cool.
You know, and it was kind of cool. Like, I got off on with Jello, and then I had to dial up Watt on Skype, and I mentioned him. He's like, you know, Jello. And Jello was like, you know, say hi to Watt for me. And, you know, I felt like I was playing, you know, the messenger between two punk rock icons.
That's pretty cool.
But unfortunately, I between those interviews, I found out that Captain Beefheart had died. And I get on the Skype with Watt, and I mentioned that to him, and he just, like, you know, kind of broke down. Like, Watt's a very emotional dude.
Yeah, he is.
And he wears, you know, wears his heart on his flannel. And, you know, he kind of just put his head into his hand for, you know, a few minutes. And I'm like,
it was a video Skype?
It was a video Skype. And I was like, oh, shit. I just, like, totally derailed this interview.
Great.
But he kind of recovered very quickly. He's like, oh, yeah, Danko Jones. Let me tell you about Danko Jones. It was cool. The thing that Watt said, which I think was really nice, was, you know, a lot of the people in this book talk about how, you know, Danko Jones is a persona, and he's kind of playing the role of the rock star. But Watt's take was, you know, Danko's very sincere. You know, he could see the sincerity in what you do, whereas a lot of people just see the sort of surface showmanship.
Well, we've had, yeah, I mean, Watt and I have had discussions, and yeah. he's seen me in the dressing room. We've played with him a few times, and not even some of the people in the book who, you know, we've even toured with have seen that side of me with Mike. And I think Watt is able to, and I'm calling him Watt just in case people know, that's how he addresses himself. I mean, Watt.
You can hear it on Sonic East Daydream Nation.
Yeah.
The song Providence, which is a answering machine recording. He's like, Thurston, Watt.
Yeah, he could, yeah, exactly. So I mean, Watt and I have had these kinds of conversations, and I think he did the video that, not the first video where he's the bartender, in the third video where he is still the bartender, but it's with, he's serving Elijah Wood a drink. That was with Ralph Macchio. So I'm in this bar with Elijah Wood, Ralph Macchio, in New York, in LA, in this seedy part of LA. And I'm just holed up in a corner with Watt, and we're just talking. And these are moments that I've had with him on every occasion I've met him. So I think that's the side he saw. And yeah. Jello's another guy where I've had conversations with that, you know, I'm not yelling at Jello or Watt. Like, I'm not like, hey, Jello, ah! You know, I'm talking to them like I'm talking to you. So they see a different side, definitely.
Yeah, and I think it's cool. Like, Jello is obviously someone with a very high bullshit detector, and he's not afraid to call people out on their shit. And so the fact that he embraced a band like yours, which gets a lot of flack from other circles.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that he can see, you know, the sort of, you know, philosophy behind what you do, and the sort of passion and the intensity, you know, I thought that was a really nice endorsement.
I have too, and I think my friendship with Jello over the years is, I value it, really. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, here's a guy I used to listen to in high school, and recently when he played Toronto, we had lunch together, and he invited me. He goes, you want to sing Too Drunk to Fuck tonight? And I said, immediately I'll say yes.
Yeah.
I mean, you say yes, you don't say no. And I went home that day, tried to learn it. And I got too arrogant. I was like, fuck, I know this. I've been listening to this since I was 14. I know this like the back of my hand. And then I started to listen to it. I'm like, oh, shit. I mean, if I'm going to be up on stage in front of people and I have to recall all these verses, that I could probably do it under my breath if I was listening to my iPod, I will freeze. And that's exactly what happened that night.
It kind of reminds me of the time I did karaoke once, and I was like, yeah, I'm going to do Mbop by Hanson. Yeah. And then the song starts, and I realize, I have no idea how the verses go to this song.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a different thing, especially when you're up on stage and, you know, like you said, you know, Jello's got a huge bullshit detector, and so do a lot of the people who follow Jello. And I'm standing there on stage going, I felt like just saying, stop, stop, guys, seriously. I've been listening to this song for more than half my life. I swear to God, I know this like the back of my hand. I'm just really having I'm dealing with like a lot of stage fright right now. And after the show, I didn't even want to go up to him. I was so embarrassed. And he said, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Reverend Horton Heat had me go up on stage once to sing, I think it was Sweet Leaf by Black Sabbath or a Sabbath song. And he forgot the words to a Sabbath song, you know, and he goes, it's just, it happens, man. And I felt so relieved because I thought I had like disrespected this staple in his life. And the title isn't really, doesn't make you think that, but I mean, but it to everybody who knows the Dead Kennedys knows that Too Drunk to Fuck is like probably the first punk rock song you ever hear when you're like 13, 14 years old going, ha, it's Too Drunk to Fuck. I knew that song before I'd even tasted a sip of alcohol.
Okay? In a way you could say that was the more punk rock thing to do was to forget the lyrics to a punk rock classic.
Sure, I guess. I mean, I just wanted to be accepted, man.
Sure. And then Lemmy, of course, was an interesting interview.
That
in
was
the sense of like all the, you know, I tried to go through official channels. Management aren't exactly in a hurry to get back to us. So JC just said, you know what, I'll text Victor from the road crew. They were playing Toronto, and we're hoping to get some FaceTime. And you know, about the day that Motorhead are playing, I'm told, yeah, just go down to soundcheck at 5 o'clock. You know, Victor will sort you out. And, you know, I've done enough interviews to know that no interview, especially ones scheduled around soundcheck, ever happen on time. So I'm waiting there, and, an hour goes by, and, like, Victor just comes out. He's like, I'm so sorry, man. Like, you know, this will happen soon, I swear. You know, I'm really, can we get you anything great? I'm like, yeah, don't worry, dude. I'm used to this. Like, waiting for an hour at soundcheck, that's like 10 minutes to me. And then like every 10 minutes he would come up, he's like, I'm really, really sorry. I'm really sorry. And it's like, it's okay. It's cool. And then finally, you know, I get my audience with Lemmy, who's very quiet speaker. You know, that one was really hard to transcribe because the tone of his voice sort of bleeds into like the ambient hiss that you get on a recording. So, but you know, he was very complimentary towards
me. I think when you finished the interview with Lemmy, you texted John, I think. And then John, it was kind of like, got the interview. got the interview. Like, it was like that.
The eagle has landed.
Yeah. And then I think it was like, well, was it good or bad?
It was good. He got what he wanted.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, he's a man of few words.
Yeah.
You know, he's not, you know, the most forthcoming conversationalist, but each of those words carries a lot of weight and wisdom.
Yes.
You can feel each of those words.
Oh, yes. And I believe that night was the last time I played there. They were playing with Nashville Pussy. And Motorhead invited me up to sing Killed by Death. That was the last time I did it. I've done it more than a dozen times with them, but that was it. And to do it in Toronto was so satisfying.
Yeah. And then I love the fact that we got Philomena Lynott as well. Like that, you know, what other book has both, you know, Lemmy and, you know, an 82-year-old rock matriarch?
And she is, man. I mean.
No, and she told a great story of seeing you that night in Dublin. And
So, I mean, this has been great, this talk that you and I have had about this book, and much needed because it's great to have this like book release thing, but I think you and I have to sit down and do a podcast for God's sakes. It's a long time coming.
Thanks for having us.
Nick's not here though.
I know. No comic relief.
No, this is really early in the morning for Nick and even for me and for you.
Yeah.
I'm glad you made time to do this.
Is this the earliest Danko Jones podcast has ever been recorded?
Earliest ever. So I'm glad that we were able to do this. And I think throughout the podcast, I think people can hear like the rat race noise out in the streets.
Rush hour in Toronto.
Yeah. But I'm glad you were able to do it and come down here.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Stuart. Oh, and thanks for writing the book and stuff. Huh?
Yeah. I'll be back when I write the sequel.
I'm glad there will be one.
train.